Side 13. November 1st. A new month. And new luck. The tunnel idea keeps nagging at me, but the difficulty till now has been something to dig the concrete out with. Then yesterday, as I was doing my prison exercise in the outer cellar, I saw a nail. A big, old one, down against the wall in the far corner. I dropped my handkerchief so that I could get a closer look. I couldn't pick it up. He watches me so closely. And it's awkward with bound hands. Then today, when I was by the nail, he always sits on the steps up. I did it on purpose. Run and get me a cigarette. They're on the chair by the door. Of course he wouldn't. He said, what's the game? I'll stay here. I won't move. Why don't you get them yourself? Because sometimes I like to remember the days when men were nice to me, that's all. I didn't think it would work, but it did. He suddenly decided that there wasn't anything I could possibly do, nothing I could pick up. He locks things away in a drawer when I come out here. So he went through the door, only a second. But I stooped like lightning and got the nail up and into my skirt pocket. Specially put on. I was standing exactly as he left me when he jumped back. So I got my nail. And made him think he could trust me. Two birds with one stone. Nothing. But it seems a tremendous victory. I've started putting my plan into effect. For days I've been telling Caliban that I don't see why D and M and everyone else should be left in the dark about whether I still exist. At least he could tell them I'm alive and all right. Tonight after supper, I told him he could buy paper from Woolworths and use gloves and so on. He tried to wriggle out of it as usual, but I kept at him. Every objection I squashed, and in the end, I felt he really was beginning to think he might do it for me. I told him he could post the letter in London to put the police off the track, and that I wanted all sorts of things from London. I've got to get him away from here for at least 3 or 4 hours because of the burglar alarms, and then I'm going to try my tunnel. What I've been thinking is that as the walls of the cellar and the outer ones are stone, not stone, then behind the stones there must be earth. All I have to do is to get through the skin of stones, and then I shall be in soft earth, I imagine. Perhaps it's all wild, but I'm in a fever to try it. The Nielsen woman. I'd met her twice more at GP's, when there were other people there. One was her husband, a Dane, some kind of importer. He spoke perfect English, so perfect it sounded wrong, affected. I met her one day when she was coming out of the hairdresser's, and I'd been in to make an appointment for Caroline. She had on that special queasy bright look women like her put on for girls of my age. What Minnie calls welcome to the tribe of women. It means they're going to treat you like a grown-up, but they don't really think you are, and anyhow they're jealous of you. She would take me for coffee. I was silly, I should have lied. It was all rhubarb about me, about her daughter, about art. She knows people and tried to dazzle me with names. But it's what people feel about art that I respect, not what or who they know. I know she can't be a lesbian, but she clings like that to one's words. Things in her eyes she doesn't dare tell you, but wants you to ask her to. You don't know what's gone on and what still goes on between GP and me, she seemed to say. I dare you to ask me. She talked on and on about Charlotte Street in the late 30s and the war. Dylan Thomas, GP. He likes you, she said. I know, I answered. But it was a shock. Both that she knew, had he told her, and that she wanted to discuss it. I know she did. He's always fallen for the really pretty ones, she said. She wanted terribly to discuss it. Then it was her daughter. She said, she's 16 now. I just can't get across to her. Sometimes when I talk to her, I feel like an animal in a zoo. She just stands outside and watches me. I knew she'd said it before. Or read it somewhere. You can always tell. They're all the same, women like her. It's not the teenagers and daughters who are different. We haven't changed. We're just young. It's the silly new middle-aged people who've got to be young who've changed. This desperate silly trying to stay with us. They can't be with us. We don't want them to be with us. We don't want them to wear our clothes styles and use our language and have our interests. They imitate us so badly that we can't respect them. But it made me feel, that meeting with her, that GP did love me, want me. That there's a deep bond between us. His loving me in his way, My liking him very much, even loving him, but not sexually, in my way. A feeling that we're groping towards a compromise. A sort of fog of unsolved desire and sadness between us. Something other people, like the N-woman, couldn't ever understand. Two people in a desert, trying to find both themselves and an oasis where they can live together. I've begun to think more and more like this. It's terribly cruel of fate to put these 20 years between us. Why couldn't he be my age, or me his? So the age thing is no longer the all-important factor that puts love right out of the question, but a sort of cruel wall fate has built between us. I don't think any more the wall is between us. I think the wall keeps us apart. November 2nd. He produced the paper after supper and dictated an absurd letter that I had to write out. And then the trouble started. I had prepared a little note, written in my smallest writing, and I slipped it into the envelope when he wasn't looking. It was very small, and in the best spy stories wouldn't have been noticed. He did. It upset him, made him see things in the cold light of reality. But he was genuinely shocked that I should be frightened. He can't imagine himself killing or raping me, and that is something. I let him have his pet, but in the end I went and tried to be nice to him, because I knew I must get him to send that letter. It was a job. I've never known him in such a huff. Wouldn't he call it a day and let me go home? No. What did he want to do with me then? Take me to bed? He gave me such a look, as if I was being really disgusting. Then I had an inspiration. I acted a little charade. His oriental slave. He likes me to play the fool. The stupidest things I do he calls witty. He's even got in the habit of joining in, stumbling after me, not that I'm very dazzling, like a giraffe. So I got him to let me write another letter. He looked in the envelope again. Then I talked him into going to London, as my plan requires. I gave him a ridiculous list of things, most of them I don't want, but it'll keep him busy to buy. I told him it was impossible to trace a letter posted in London, so he finally agreed. He likes me to wheedle the brute. One request. No, I don't ask him for things. I order them. I commanded him to try and buy a George Paston. I gave him a list of galleries where he might find things by GP. I even tried to get him to go to the studio. But as soon as he heard it was in Hampstead, he smelt a rat. He wanted to know if I knew this George Paston. I said no, well, just by name. But it didn't sound very convincing. And I was afraid he wouldn't buy any of his pictures anywhere. So I said, he's a casual friend of mine. He's quite old, but he's a very good painter. And he badly needs money, and I should very much like some of his pictures. We could hang them on the wall. If you bought straight from him, he wouldn't be paying money to the galleries. But I can see you're frightened to go, I said. So there's an end to it. Of course, he didn't fall for that. He wanted to know if GP was one of those paint-pot-at-the-wall chaps. I just gave him a look. I was only joking. Then don't. After a bit, he said, he would want to know where I came from and all. I told him what he could say, and he said he'd think about it, which is Calabanese for no. It was too much to expect. And there probably won't be anything in any of the galleries. And I don't worry, because I'm not going to be here this time tomorrow. I'm going to escape. He'll go off after breakfast. He's going to leave my lunch. So I shall have 4 or 5 hours. Unless he cheats and doesn't get all I've asked. But he's never failed before. I felt sorry for Caliban this evening. He will suffer when I'm gone. There'll be nothing left. He'll be alone with all his sex neuroses and his class neuroses and his uselessness and his emptiness. He's asked for it. I'm not really sorry. But I'm not absolutely unsorry. November 4th. I couldn't write yesterday. Too fed up. I was so stupid. I got him away all yesterday. I had hours to escape. But I never really thought of the problems. I saw myself scooping out handfuls of soft, loamy earth. The nail was useless. It wouldn't dig the cement properly. I thought it would crumble away. It was terribly hard. I took hours to get one stone out. There wasn't earth behind, but another stone. A bigger one. chalk. And I couldn't even find where its edge was. I got another stone out of the wall, but it didn't help. There was the same huge stone behind. I began to get desperate. I saw the tunnel was no good. I hit violently at the door. I tried to force it with the nail and managed to hurt my hand. That's all. All I had at the end was a sore hand and broken fingernails. I'm just not strong enough without tools, even with tools. In the end, I put the stones back and powdered as well as I could the cement and mixed it with water and talcum powder to camouflage the hole. It's typical of the states I get in here. I suddenly told myself that the digging would have to be done over a number of days. The only stupid thing was to expect to do it all in one. So I spent a long time trying to hide the place. But it was no good. Little bits fell out. And I'd started in the most obvious place where he's bound to spot it. So I gave up. I suddenly decided it was all petty, stupid, useless, like a bad drawing. Unrescuable. When he came at last, he saw it at once. He always sniffs round as soon as he enters. Then he started to see how far I'd gone. I sat on the bed and watched him. In the end, I threw the nail at him. He cemented the stones back. He says it's solid chalk behind, all the way round. I haven't speak to him all the evening. Or look at the things he'd bought, even though I could see one of them was a picture frame. I took a sleeping pill and went to bed straight after supper. Then, this morning, I woke up early. Before he came down, I decided to pass it off as something unimportant, to be normal. Not to give in. I unpacked all the things he'd bought. First of all, there was GP's picture. It's a drawing of a girl, young woman, a nude, like anything else of his I've seen. And I think it must be something he did a long time ago. It is his. It has his simplicity of line. Hatred of fussiness. Of Topolskyitis. She's half turned away, hanging up or taking down a dress from a hook. A pretty face? It's difficult to say. Rather a heavy, myol body. It's not worth dozens of things he's done since. But real. I kissed it when I unwrapped it. I've been looking at some of the lines, not as lines, but as things he's touched, all morning now. Not love. Humanity. Caliban was surprised that I seemed so positively gay when he came in. I thanked him for all he'd bought. I said, "You can't be a proper prisoner if you don't try to escape. And now don't let's talk about it. Agreed?" He said that he'd telephoned every gallery I gave him the name of. There was only the one thing. "Thank you very much," I said. "May I keep it down here? And when I go, I'll give it to you." "I shan't." He said he'd rather have a drawing of mine in any case. I asked him if he'd posted the letter. He said he had, but I saw he was going red. I told him I believed him, and that it would be such a dirty trick not to post the letter that I was sure he must have posted it. I feel almost certain he funked it, as he funked the check. It would be just like him. But nothing I say will make him post it. So I've decided that I will suppose he has posted it. Midnight. I had to stop. He came down. We'd been playing the records he bought. Bartok's Music for Percussion and Celeste. The loveliest. It made me think of Collioure. Last summer. The day we went, all four of us with the French students, up through the ilexes to the tower. The ilexes. An absolutely new colour. Amazing chestnut, rufous, burning, bleeding where they had cut away the cork. The cicadas. The wild azure sea through the stems and the heat and the smell of everything burnt in it. Piers and I and everyone except Minnie got a bit tipsy. Sleeping in the shade, waking up, staring through the leaves at the cobalt blue sky, thinking how impossible things were to paint. How can some blue pigment ever mean the living blue light of the sky? I suddenly felt I didn't want to paint. Painting was just showing off. The thing was to experience, and experience forevermore. The beautiful, clean sun, on the blood-red stems. And coming back, I had a long talk with the nice, shy boy, Jean-Louis. His bad English and my bad French, yet we understood each other. Terribly timid he was, frightened of Piers. Jealous of him. Jealous of his throwing an arm round me. The silly lad Piers is. And when I discovered he was going to be a priest. Piers was so crude afterwards. That stupid, clumsy, frightened of being soft English male cruelty to the truth. He couldn't see that, of course, poor Jean-Louis liked me. Of course he was sexually attracted, but there was this other thing. It wasn't really shyness, it was a determination to try to be a priest and to live in the world. A simply colossal effort of coming to terms with oneself. Like destroying all the paintings one's ever done and making a new start. Only he had to do it every day. Every time he saw a girl he liked. And all Piers could say was, I bet he's having dirty dreams about you. So ghastly, that arrogance, that insensitivity of boys who've been to public schools. Piers is always going on about how he hated Stowe, as if that solves everything, as if to hate something means it can't have affected you. I always know when he doesn't understand something. He gets cynical. He says something shocking. When I told GP about it much later, he just said, poor frog. He was probably on his knees praying to forget you. Watching Piers throw stones out to sea. Where was it? Somewhere near Valencia. So beautiful. Like a young god. All golden brown with his dark hair. His swimming slip. And Minnie said, she was lying beside me, oh, it's so clear. She said, wouldn't it be wonderful if Piers was dumb? And then she said, could you go to bed with him? I said, no. Then, I don't know. Piers came up just then and wanted to know what she was smiling about. Nanda's just told me a secret, she said. About you. Piers made some feeble joke and went off to get the lunch from the car with Peter. What's the secret, I wanted to know. Bodies beat minds, she said. Clever Carmen Gray always knows what to say. I knew you'd say that, she said. She was doodling in the sand, and I was on my tummy watching her. She said, what I mean is he's so terribly good-looking, one could forget he's so stupid. You might think I could marry him and teach him, couldn't you? And you know you couldn't. Or you could go to bed with him just for fun, and one day you'd suddenly find you were in love with his body, and you couldn't live without it, and you'd be stuck with his rotten mind forever and ever. And then she said, doesn't it terrify you? Not more than so many other things. I'm serious. If you married him, I'd never speak to you again. And she was serious. That very quick, grey, shy look she puts on like a little lance. I got up and kissed her on the way up and went to meet the boys. And she sat there, still looking down at the sand. We're both terrible lookers through. We can't help it. But she's always said, I believe this. I shall act like this. It's got to be someone you at least feel is your equal, who can look through as well as you. And the body thing's always got to be second. And I've always secretly thought, Carmen will be another spinster. It's too complicated for set ideas. But now I think of GP, and I compare him to Piers. And Piers has got nothing on his side. Just a golden body, throwing stones aimlessly into the sea. November 5th. I gave him hell tonight. I started throwing things around upstairs. First cushions and then plates. I've been longing to break them. But I was beastly, really. Spoilt. He suffered it all. He's so weak. He ought to have slapped me across the face. He did catch hold of me to stop me breaking another of his wretched plates. He so rarely touch. I hated it. It was like icy water. I lectured him. I told him all about himself and what he ought to do in life, but he doesn't listen. He likes me to talk about him. It doesn't matter what I say. I won't write any more. I'm reading Sense and Sensibility, and I must find out what happens to Marianne. Marianne is me. Eleanor is me, as I ought to be. What happens if he has a crash? A stroke? Anything. I die. I couldn't get out. All I did the day before yesterday was to prove it. November 6th. It's afternoon. No lunch. Another escape. So nearly, it seemed at one point. But it never was. He's a devil. I tried the appendicitis trick. I thought of it weeks ago. I've always thought of it as a last resort. Something I must not bungle through unpreparedness. I didn't write about it here, in case he found this. I rubbed talc into my face. Then, when he knocked on the door this morning, I swallowed a whole lot of saved-up salt and water and pressed my tongue, and the timing was perfect. He came in and was sick. I put on a tremendous act. Lying on the bed with my hair in a mess and holding my tummy, still in my pyjamas and dressing gown, groaning a little as if I was being terribly bred. All the time he stood and said, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" We had a sort of desperate, broken conversation, Caliban trying to get out of taking me to hospital, and I insisting that he must. And then suddenly he seemed to give way. He muttered something about it being the end and rushed out. I heard the iron door go. I was still staring at the wall, but no bolts. Then the outer door. And there was silence. It was weird. So sudden. So complete. Yes, it worked. I pulled on some socks and shoes and ran to the iron door. It had sprung back an inch or two. It was open. I thought it might be all a trap. So I kept up the act. I opened the door and said his name in a quiet voice and hobbled weakly across the cellar and up the steps. I could see the light. He hadn't locked the outer door either. It flashed across my mind that it was just what he would do. He wouldn't go to the doctor. He'd run away, crack up completely, but he'd take the van. So I would hear the engine. But I couldn't. I must have waited several minutes. I should have known, but I couldn't bear the suspense. I pulled the door open and rushed out. And he was there. At once. In all the daylight. I couldn't pretend I was ill. I put shoes on. He had something, a hammer in his hand. Peculiar, wide eyes. I'm sure he was going to attack me. We sort of stood poised for a moment, neither of us knowing what to do. Then I turned and ran back. I don't know why. I didn't stop to think. He came after me, but he stopped when he saw me go inside, as I instinctively knew he would. The only safe place from him was down here. I heard him come, and the bolts were shot too. I know it was the right thing to do. It saved my life. If I'd screamed or tried to escape, he would have battered me to death. There are moments when he's possessed, quite out of his own control. His trick. Midnight. He brought me supper down here. He didn't say a word. I'd spent the afternoon doing a strip cartoon of him. The awful tale of a harmless boy. Absurd. But I have to keep the reality and the horror at bay. He starts by being a nice little clerk and ends up as a drooling horror film monster. When he was going, I showed it to him. He didn't laugh. He simply looked at it carefully. "It's only natural," he said. He meant that I should make such fun of him. I'm one in a row of specimens. It's when I try to flutter out of line that he hates me. I'm meant to be dead, pinned, always the same, always beautiful. He knows that part of my beauty is being alive, but it's the dead me he wants. He wants me living but dead. I felt it terribly strongly today. That my being alive and changing and having a separate mind and having moods and all that was becoming a nuisance. He is solid. Immovable, iron-willed. He showed me one day what he called his killing bottle. I'm imprisoned in it, fluttering against the glass. Because I can see through it, I still think I can escape. I have hope. that it's all an illusion. A thick, round wall of glass. November 7th. How the days drag. Today. Intolerably long. My one consolation is GP's drawing. It grows on me. On one. It's the only living, unique, created thing here. It's the first thing I look at when I wake up. The last thing at night. I stand in front of it and stare at it. I know every line. He made a fudge of one of her feet. There's something slightly unbalanced about the whole composition, as if there's a tiny bit missing somewhere. But it lives. After supper, we're back to normal. Caliban handed me The Catcher in the Rye and said, I've read it. I knew at once by his tone that he meant, and I don't think much of it. I feel awake. I'll do a dialogue. Well, I don't see much point in it. You realize this is one of the most brilliant studies of adolescence ever written. He sounds a mess to me. Of course he's a mess. But he realizes he's a mess. He tries to express what he feels. He's a human being for all his faults. Don't you even feel sorry for him? I don't like the way he talks. I don't like the way you talk. But I don't treat you as below any serious notice or sympathy. I suppose it's very clever to write like that and all. I gave you that book to read because I thought you would feel identified with him. You're a Holden Caulfield. He doesn't fit anywhere and you don't. I don't wonder the way he goes on. Doesn't try to fit. He tries to construct some sort of reality in his life, some sort of decency. Ah, it's not realistic going to a posh school and his parents having money. He wouldn't behave like that, in my opinion. I know what you are. You're the old man of the sea. Who's he? The horrid old man Sinbad had to carry on his back. That's what you are. You get on the back of everything vital. Everything trying to be honest and free, and you bear it down. I won't go on. We argued. No, we don't argue. I say things and he tries to wriggle out of them. It's true. He is the old man of the sea. I can't stand stupid people like Caliban, with their great dead weight of pettiness and selfishness and meanness of every kind. And the few have to carry it all. The doctors and the teachers and the artists. Not that they haven't their traitors. But what hope there is with them. With us. Because I'm one of them. I'm one of them. I feel it and I've tried to prove it. I felt it during my last year at Ladymont. There were the few of us who cared. And there were the silly ones, the snobbish ones, the would-be debutantes, and the daddy's darlings, and the horsophiles, and the sex cats. I'll never go back to Ladymont, because I couldn't stand that suffocating atmosphere of the done thing and the right people and the nice behaviour. Boadicea writing, in spite of her weird political views on my report. How dared she? I will not be an old girl of such a place. Why should we tolerate their beastly Calibanity? Why should every vital and creative and good person be martyred by the great universal stodge around? In this situation, I'm a representative. A martyr. Imprisoned. Unable to grow. At the mercy of this resentment. This hateful millstone envy of the Calibans of this world. Because they all hate us. They hate us for being different. For not being them. For their own not being like us. They persecute us. They crowd us out. They send us to Coventry. They sneer at us. They yawn at us. They blindfold themselves and stuff up their ears. They do anything to avoid having to take notice of us and respect us. They go crawling after the great ones among us when they're dead. They pay thousands and thousands for the Van Goghs and Modiglianis they'd have spat on at the time they were painted. Guffawed at. Made coarse jokes about. I hate them. I hate the uneducated and the ignorant. I hate the pompous and the phony. I hate the jealous and the resentful. I hate the crabbed and the mean and the petty. I hate all ordinary, dull little people who aren't ashamed of being dull and little. I hate what GP calls the new people.
The new class people with their cars and their money and their tellies and their stupid vulgarities and their stupid, crawling imitation of the bourgeoisie. I love honesty and freedom and giving. I love making. I love doing. I love being to the full. I love everything which is not sitting and watching and copying and dead at heart. GP was laughing at my being Labour one day, early on. I remember he said, "You're supporting the party which brought the new people into existence. Do you realise that?" I said, I was shocked, because from what he'd said about other things, I thought he must be Labour. I knew he'd been a communist once. I'd rather we had the new people than poor people. He said, "The new people are still the poor people. Theirs is the new form of poverty. The others hadn't any money, and these haven't any soul." He suddenly said, "Have you read Major Barbara? How it proved people had to be saved financially before you could save their souls." "They forgot one thing," he said. "They brought in the welfare state, but they forgot Barbara herself. Affluence, affluence, and not a soul to see." No, he's wrong somewhere. He was exaggerating. One must be on the left. Every decent person I've ever met has been anti-Tory. But I see what he feels. I mean, I feel it myself more and more. This awful dead weight of the fat little new people on everything. Corrupting everything. Vulgarizing everything. Raping the countryside, as Dee says in his squire moods. Everything mass-produced. Mass everything. I know we're supposed to face the herd. Control the stampede. It's like a Wild West film. Work for them and tolerate them. I shall never go to the Ivory Tower. That's the most despicable thing, to choose to leave life because it doesn't suit you. But sometimes it is frightening, thinking of the struggle life is, if one takes it seriously. All this is talk. Probably I shall meet someone and fall in love with him and marry him, and things will seem to change and I shan't care any more. I shall become a little woman. One of the enemy. That this is what I feel these days. That I belong to a sort of band of people who have to stand against all the rest. I don't know who they are. Famous men, dead and living, who fought for the right things and created and painted in the right way. And unfamous people I know who don't lie about things, who try not to be lazy, who try to be human and intelligent. Yes, people like GP, for all his faults. His fault. They're not even good people. They have weak moments. Sex moments and drink moments. Coward and money moments. They have holidays in the Ivory Tower. But a part of them is one with the band. The few. November 9th. I'm vain. I'm not one of them. I want to be one of them. And that's not the same thing. Of course, Caliban is not typical of the new people. He's hopelessly out of date. He will call the record player the gramophone. And there's his lack of confidence. They're not ashamed of themselves. I remember Dee saying they think they're all equal to the best as soon as they have a telly and a car. But deep down, Caliban's one of them. There's this hatred of the unusual, this wanting everybody to be the same, and the awful misuse of money. Why should people have money if they don't know how to use it? It sickens me every time I think of all the money Caliban has won, and of all the other people like him who win money. So selfish, so evil. GP said that day, "The honest poor are the moneyless, vulgar rich. Poverty forces them to have good qualities and pride in other things besides money. Then, when they have money, they don't know what to do with it. They forget all the old virtues, which weren't real virtues anyway. They think the only virtue is to make more money and to spend. They can't imagine that there are people to whom money is nothing. That the most beautiful things are quite independent of money." I'm not being frank. I still want money. But I know that's wrong. I believe GP. I don't have to believe him when he says it. I can see it's true. He hardly worries about money at all. He has just enough to buy his materials to live, to have a working holiday every year, to manage. And there are a dozen others.
Peter?
Bill MacDonald? Stefan?
They don't live in the world of money. If they have it, they spend it.
If they don't, they go without. Persons like Caliban have no head for money. They've only got to have a little like the new people, and they become beastly. All the horrid people who wouldn't give me money when I was collecting, I could tell, I only had to look in their faces.
Bourgeois people give because they're embarrassed if you pester them.
Intelligent people give, or at least they look honestly at you and say no. They're not ashamed not to give. But the new people are too mean to give and too small to admit it. Like the horrid man in Hampstead, he was one of them who said, "I'll give you half a dollar if you can prove it doesn't go into someone's pocket." He thought he was being funny. I turned my back on him, which was wrong, because my pride was less important than the children. So I put a half crown in for him later. But I still hate him. With Caliban, it's as if somebody made him drink a whole bottle of whiskey. He can't take it. The only thing that kept him decent before was being poor, being stuck to one place and job. It's like putting a blind man in a fast car and telling him to drive where and how he likes. A nice thing to end with. The Bach record came today. I've played it twice already. Caliban said it was nice, but he wasn't musical. However, he sat with the right sort of expression on his face. I'm going to play the parts I like again. I'm going to lie in bed in the darkness and the music and think I'm with GP. And he's lying over there with his eyes shut and his pitted cheek and his Jew's nose, as if he was on his own tomb, only there's nothing of death in him. Even so, this evening, Caliban was late coming down.
"Where have you been?"
I snapped at him. He just looked surprised, said nothing. I said,
"You seem so late."
I often want him to come. I'm as lonely as that. November 10th. We had an argument this evening about his money. I said he ought to give most of it away. I tried to shame him into giving some away. But he won't trust anything. That's what's really wrong with him. Like my man in Hampstead, he doesn't trust people to collect money and use it for the purpose they say they will. He thinks everyone is corrupt. Everyone tries to get money and keep it. It's no good my saying I know it's used for the right purpose. He says, "Well, how do you know?" And of course I can't tell him. I can only say I feel sure it must go where it's needed. And then he smiles as if I'm too naive to have any right on my side. I accused him, not very bitterly, of not having sent the CND check. I challenged him to produce a receipt. He said the gift was anonymous. He hadn't sent his address. It was on the tip of my tongue to say, "I shall go and find out when I'm free." But I didn't, because it would be one more reason for him not to set me free. He was red. I'm sure he was lying, as he lied about the letter to D&M. It's not so much a lack of generosity, a real miserliness. He spends hundreds of pounds on me. He'd kill me with kindness, with chocolates and cigarettes and food and flowers. I said I'd like some French perfume the other evening. It was just a whim, really, but this room smells of disinfectant and air wick. I have enough baths, but I don't feel clean. And I said I wished I could go and sniff the various scents to see which I liked best. He came in this morning with 14 different bottles. He'd ransacked all the chemist's shops. It's mad. £40 worth. It's like living in the Arabian Nights, being the favourite in the harem. But the one perfume you really want is freedom. If I could put a starving child before him and give it food and let him watch it grow well, I know he'd give money. But everything beyond what he pays for and sees himself get is suspicious to him. He doesn't believe in any other world but the one he lives in and sees. He's the one in prison, in his own hateful, narrow, present world. November 12th. The last night but one. I daren't think about it. about not escaping. I've kept reminding him recently, but now I feel I should have sprung it on him more or less suddenly. Today I decided that I would organize a little party tomorrow night. I shall say I feel differently towards him, that I want to be his friend and lame-duck him in London. It won't be altogether a lie. I feel a responsibility towards him that I don't really understand. I so often hate him. I think I ought to forever hate him, yet I don't always. My pity wins, and I do want to help him. I think of people I could introduce him to. He could go to Caroline's psychiatrist friend. I'd be like Emma and arrange a marriage for him, and with happier results. Some little Harriet Smith, with whom he could be mousy and sane and happy. I know I have to steel myself against not being freed. I tell myself it's a chance in 100 that he'll keep his word. But he must keep his word.
End of side 13.